As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly. Welcome to another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report. Once again, our good friends at Miami Book Fair have brought us another interesting author. And this time we have Josh Levine, the author of The Queen, The Forgotten Life Behind an American Myth. Our guest today is Josh Levine, and he is the author of The Queen, The Forgotten Life Behind an American Myth, and is a fascinating account of American racism and an expose of the welfare queen myth. And he will be at the Miami Book Fair on November 23rd. It's a Saturday and at 4 o'clock. And there'll be a discussion of with Elizabeth Flock, reporter and producer for PBS NewsHour. And the book has been very well received. It's said, the Washington Post said it reads like a detective story. And Daily Beast called it one of the most outlandish true crime capers of the season. And I guess maybe to put this book in context, as we jump in and give our guests a chance to speak, is that imagine a story about Bernie Goetz where he was just described as a turnstile jumper. Well, Josh is going to tell us why the story of the welfare queen is actually much more complex, but it has a lot of political dynamics. So why don't we start, Josh, with explaining who is the welfare queen?
Thank you for having me. And yeah, Linda Taylor in 1974 was written up by the Chicago Tribune as a woman who got public aid in the state of Illinois under multiple different names, despite the fact that she was driving a bunch of luxury cars, including a Cadillac, that she was about to go on a Hawaiian vacation. She allegedly owned all of these buildings in Chicago. So they made it out like she was, somebody who was gaming the system in this really obscene way and hadn't been punished for it. And then within a couple of weeks, the Tribune started calling her the welfare queen. And that term, in connection to her, really caught on. It was used by media outlets across the country, and Taylor became this infamous American villain in the mid-1970s.
And what's interesting about it is there was reasons why she became the villain, and one of them, which is her race.
Yeah, she was portrayed as somebody who could actually change her race, that she was kind of chameleonic and that she was a shape-shifting con artist who could represent herself as Black or white or Asian or Latina, depending on what her target was. And she was predominantly, you know, in the context of this welfare fraud case, seen as Black, though. And this was a time when welfare in the United States was extremely racialized. Just the term welfare kind of connoted poor Black recipients. And that was because in the aftermath of the civil rights movement, and there was also a related welfare rights movement, a lot of people of color were granted benefits that they had been denied before. And so even though Black people were not the majority of welfare recipients, this notion that it was a quote unquote Black program really took root. And the fact that Taylor was then seen as this notorious welfare cheat rendered all welfare recipients, but I think particularly Black ones, suspicious in the eyes of many, many Americans.
And that's an important point to highlight, is that it was white Americans who were the majority of welfare recipients, even though that it was not how it was portrayed politically.
Yeah, that's correct. And there's a scholar named Martin Gillens who has a book called Why Americans Hate Welfare. And in that book, he documents how between the 1960s and the 1970s, the proportion of photographs in news magazines in stories that are connected with poverty just shifted dramatically, that poverty was depicted as white in the 1960s. This was
ready
kind
to
of
do a podcast for
Michael
your business.
Arrington's The Other America.
Right.
This notion of poverty as being a rural white issue. And then again, in the aftermath of the war on poverty, the civil rights movement, riots and Watts and elsewhere, you see poverty being coded as Black. And the actual statistics, the numbers don't shift at all. The percentage of you know, poor Americans is not going through any kind of dramatic change. It's just the perception. And then in the 70s, you know, in these magazines, when there's articles written about poverty, it's all Black people that are depicted in these images. And so, you know, that is definitely a part of this Linda Taylor story.
And it became a national story when Ronald Reagan incorporated it into his campaign speech in 1976.
Yeah, that's correct. So Reagan and his advisors saw the news coverage of this and I think correctly intuited that it would be a really powerful anecdote that he could use on the stump. As governor of California from 1967 to 1975, he had pushed through some pretty strict, you know, controls in the welfare system there. And so when he decided to run for president, he wanted to run on that record. And he also wanted to establish to his voters or people that might be inclined to, you know, listen to what he had to say, that welfare abuse and fraud and cheating was a major problem in America. And so he cherry picked this anecdote, and he would say that there was a woman in Chicago who gets welfare under all these different names. And he quoted a figure of $150,000 in a single year, which was a really exaggerated sum. And crowds were shocked by this. They would gasp. And it really helped cement Taylor as a villain, but also this idea that welfare cheating was this huge problem in America and that Reagan positioning himself as the one who could solve it.
And how much had Taylor received?
So there was a huge gap between the political rhetoric around Taylor and her welfare fraud and the actual facts on the ground. So she was ultimately indicted for taking between $8,000 and $9,000 total over a period of several years. The prosecutor said that was all that they could prove, so they weren't convinced that it was only that amount. An estimate that I saw put it more around like $40,000, again, over a period of many years. So Reagan saying it was $150,000 in a single year, he didn't invent that figure himself. He got it from state officials in Illinois, but those officials themselves had no factual basis, as far as I could find, for citing that figure. And so it's important to note that Taylor did actually commit welfare fraud. She did not commit fraud to the extent that Reagan said that she did. And the welfare fraud that she committed was not at all representative. It was an outlier case. And it also obscured other crimes that she committed that I believe were far more serious.
Although a lot of those crimes happened later, right?
There was a mix, actually. So she was accused. She was arrested for kidnapping in 1967, which was before. She was arrested for welfare fraud in 1974. In 1975, when she was out on bail after the welfare fraud charges, so just a year later, she was accused of homicide. A woman that she was living with died under mysterious circumstances. And so she was a career criminal. And so she was someone who started, her rap sheet began in the 1940s, and it continued, for decades after this welfare fraud charge and ultimate conviction. And one of the things I did in the book was I found out what happened to her after she was convicted of welfare fraud, because she had just kind of disappeared. Nobody had really tracked down what had happened to her and what the real story was.
And in fact, because she had disappeared, and because Reagan continued to use this as a political story in 76 and then in 80, when he ran successfully, there was a belief in some media, liberal media, that this person didn't exist, that it was just someone Reagan had invented.
Yeah, that was fascinating to me, looking at the coverage. I started reporting on this in 2012, and finding that despite the pretty voluminous, body of reporting on her in the 70s, that, in the early 1980s, people were writing that the story was entirely fictional, that Linda Taylor never existed. And I think that was the reason that writers said that was just because of Reagan's reputation and record of exaggeration. We've already talked about it in this conversation. And so Reagan was not really being given the benefit of the doubt for understandable reasons. And yet the fact that, Taylor was forgotten, erased from history, I think actually served to dehumanize her. And, other women who came after Taylor were also known as the welfare queen. She had kind of successors. And there was just this lack of curiosity about her as a person, both from the political establishment and from writers later who were seeking to discredit Reagan.
Well, because she gave life to a stereotype.
She did give life to
a
stereotype
that they wanted to push.
Yeah, and it was really pernicious, the way in which she was used and the way that this one outlier story was deployed to make it seem like poor people were getting rich off of public benefits, which is just extremely untrue, and was used to actually cut public benefits. When Reagan became president, he would tell the Linda Taylor story as a way to argue that food stamps and aid to families with dependent children needed to be cut because these programs were allegedly beset by abuse. And so, yeah, the Taylor story, the way that it was told, was actually extremely harmful. And yet the story of Taylor, you know, the way that it was kind of sanded down, if Reagan had mentioned, which he didn't, that she had been accused of kidnapping and murder, I think it would have been more clear to the people hearing that story that Taylor was not representative, that she was this outlier, and that she right. didn't kind of stand in for anyone but herself.
And then that's why I opened it with imagine, you know, Bernie Goetz being known as a turnstile jumper and not for the, you know, being the, you know, who he was in terms of shooting kids on the subway. But this is, you know, here's someone who's actually had a life of crime and is known for a relatively minor offense in relation to the other offenses.
Yeah. So Taylor's victims, she had institutional victims. She was taking money from the public purse, but also, you know, the woman that she was accused of killing was a Black woman who lived on the South Side of Chicago at a time when, there were more murders around that time. There were 970 in a single year, far more than in any other year in the history of Chicago. And the, you know, mainstream, predominantly white journalistic institutions of Chicago didn't think this was particularly interesting or a scandal that this woman was killed. And so the welfare queen image was so powerful, and this idea of welfare fraud was so, considered such a violation that it even could overwhelm a potential murder. And I found that just to be totally shocking. And yet that's Linda Taylor's story.
And why didn't the press jump at the story? I mean, here's someone who had definitely sold a lot of newspaper copy, a front page coverage of her trial. Why wouldn't the press want to publicize this further?
There were isolated stories about kidnapping charges and about the homicide allegation, but they just weren't followed up on. And they never made it into the national press. And I think that was partly because of the way that Reagan told the story. He didn't include any of that information. And so when Taylor became a national figure, these other allegations weren't really attached to her in a prominent way. But I think it was because, her victims were not people that were broadly really cared about or seen as important. And they didn't, these allegations didn't really fit into this larger national story or idea. There wasn't kind of a larger point to be made about it. And it actually weakened the larger point by making it clear that Taylor was an outlier. So she fits into this idea that welfare abuse, welfare cheating is kind of causing economic problems in America, that it's making the hardworking American taxpayer poorer. And that idea was really appealing to people at a time when the economy was really bad. And so that was the story that was told.
Yeah, and I mean, 1980, you had the recession, and in 76, when Reagan emerged in the challenge against Ford, you had a lot of high inflation, a lot of, there were oil shocks, and the economy was rattling from the removal of the price controls imposed under Nixon. And there was a lot going on in that era. And then just the whole dramatic change that had happened in terms of, the political shifts with the civil rights for African Americans and women. Reagan kind of appealed to a certain sense of racial resentment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you make a great point about the inflation and oil shocks in the mid-70s. It was a time when a large proportion of the American populace was looking for somebody to blame for, it wasn't the most happy time in America. And the poor, people who don't have that much of a voice in the media or in political life. We're a convenient target. It's reminiscent to me of a lot of the rhetoric around undocumented immigrants today, where you have people who, you know, even in communities where immigration isn't really that prominent, where there aren't that many immigrants, it's still kind of powerful political rhetoric to blame immigrants for whatever problems are in the community, economic issues. And so, I think that's just a trend that recurs throughout American life, even if the target changes.
So what made you want to, unmask or revisit the welfare queen?
Fascinated by American political history, and I had not lived through this period, and I had known the term welfare queen, but I hadn't known that it had originated with and been connected to one person in particular. And so that just on its face interested me, that I hadn't known that. And then when I went and looked back at the coverage, and I saw that Linda Taylor had been infamous for really about a 3-year period in the mid-70s, but her entire life before that and after that was really unknown, it just seemed like a really alluring task for a journalist to go and try to sift fact from fiction and figure out if there was anything behind the rumors and innuendo behind her, and also just to try to humanize this person who had been so dehumanized. And I think humanizing doesn't mean make the person look better than they were. It's actually telling the full story and the full scope of their life and not reducing it to a trope.
Right. Now, Reagan, I've seen some of your other writings where you talk about the 1980 campaign and Reagan's using racial resentment, particularly his opening speech in, I forget the county, but near Philadelphia, Mississippi.
In Neshoba County Fair.
Yes. Using the phrase states' rights, where, the four civil rights workers had been killed only, 16 years earlier, was the welfare queen part of that speech?
She was not a part of that particular speech. She was cited in other parts of the 1980 campaign, but it's important to note that in that states' rights speech and in, when Reagan would talk about Linda Taylor, he wouldn't explicitly talk about race. He actually wouldn't use the term welfare queen. He did use it a couple of times, but it was not a part of his standard stump speech. And so there was a kind of, deniability there that the folks that were listening to him knew what he was talking about and referring to. And Reagan would have had to have been incredibly naive not to understand what he was saying and doing. And I don't believe he was that naive. But he did have this ability to communicate with people on kind of multiple levels. And I think that's what was happening with the Taylor story and with that speech in Mississippi.
Now, you're the editor, national editor at Slate, and you have a sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen. How long have you been doing that?
I've been at Slate since 2003, and I've been doing the podcast since 2009.
And in addition to that podcast, you also have a series podcast on the book.
Yeah, it's also called The Queen, and I thought it was important to bring forward the voices of people that knew her, that knew Linda Taylor, that had run across her. Her defense attorney speaks in that podcast, as well as people that were her victims. And if you read the book, I think you would find the podcast to be a really great supplement to really hear the story in those people's own words. I was really glad to be able to do it.
I listened to the podcast. It was really interesting. And even like hearing Clarence Page talk about, you know, the reporter and who broke the story and that time. And I recommend it, you know, for those. The book is available, The Queen, available on Amazon and all other where you buy books. But the podcast is on Slate, right?
Yeah, you can find it wherever you get your podcast, Apple Podcasts or wherever else.
And I know we only have a little bit of time left. I want to thank you and once again reiterate that you will be at the Miami Book Fair at Miami-Dade College on Saturday, November 23rd at 4 p.m., room 8203, and you'll be talking about your new book, The Queen. So thank you, Josh, for joining us, and look forward to following you on Slate. So good luck in Miami. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have more CyberLaw and Business Report only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the CyberLaw and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Ready to do a podcast for your business? Make that podcast elevate to enterprise level. Let WebmasterRadio.fm expedite and execute your podcast to build your brand and broaden your customer base. WebmasterRadio.fm has worked with the world's biggest tech brands, Google, Yahoo, and Bing, and have worked with fast-growing brands like ShipStation and GoDaddy. Now it's your turn. Contact BRASCO at WMR.fm and rush your enterprise-level podcast into production at a very reasonable rate. Email BRASCO at WMR.fm.
It passes before it's noticed. A slight rising of the eyebrows, a widening of the eyes. It may be accompanied by an almost imperceptible inhalation. The heart adds a beat like a quiet exclamation point on the experience. Within a tenth of a second, the reaction has passed, but not without leaving its mark. Someone found what they're looking for. Does your website deliver impulses to act? It can. Intended Consequences is the podcast for digital marketers who see their job as changing hearts and minds. If you're frustrated, bored, or in a rut, it's time to spread your wings with me, Brian Massey, and my guests. Find out how successful, curious, creative, and data-driven marketers are making a difference on purpose. Visit intendedpodcast.com or find us where you get your podcasts. Intended Consequences. Marketing on purpose.
Miami may be the sun and fun capital of the world, but it's also home to the largest literary festival in the U.S. Don't miss the Miami Book Fair, a week-long festival featuring more than 600 authors from all over the world with readings, signings, and panels, capped off by a three-day street fair. Find books in English, Spanish, and Creole for every interest and every age, from biographies and novels to poetry and comics. This year, come meet poets Richard Blanco, Reginald Dwayne Betts, and Joy Harjo. Award-winning novelists T.C. Boyle, Susan Choi, Edwidge Danticat, Taya Obreht, Julie Oranger, Leonard Pitts, and Karen Russell. Plus authors exploring issues of the day such as Eve Ensler, Alex Kutlowitz, Danny Shapiro, Daryl Pinkney, Ambassador Samantha Power, George Will, and hundreds more. Take the little ones to Children's Alley for hands-on activities, characters, and storytelling. Enjoy music, food, and fun for the whole family right on the downtown Miami-Dade College campus, November 17th to the 24th. For details, schedules, and tickets, visit miamibookfair.com.
You are now tuned in to the world's largest online radio podcast network for internet marketers looking to dominate the B2B marketplace.
Webmasterradio.fm.
Webmasterradio.fm is home to some of the most respected authorities in all aspects of internet marketing, from SEO to affiliate marketing to social media, e-commerce, mobile marketing, and so much more. Our hosts travel to all stretches of the world and speak to the impact players that are affecting our industry. On air, on demand, and available on every mobile device that you can imagine. This is WebmasterRadio.fm.
WebmasterRadio.fm.
We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
With Eric Boghossian, who is the author of Operation Nemesis, the assassination plot that avenged the Armenian genocide, and the acclaimed writer and actor, has written several books. But this is your first work of nonfiction, right?
That's right, yeah.
Now, one thing you mentioned is that not only were the killings, kind of retribution, vigilante justice for people from the Armenian genocide who had escaped because of the confusion of World War One. It also had a long-term historical impact in that it cleared the way for Ataturk to assume power in Turkey.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I was really interested in this story. Usually when Armenians or most historians talk about the Armenian genocide, they seem to see it as something happening within the borders of the Ottoman Empire or Turkey, and that's it. And of course, that's where most of the killings happened, there and in northern Syria. But contextualize it more, you see other patterns evolve. Very importantly, the first thing that shows up is British interest in oil in the Middle East and their need to preserve their foothold, particularly at the end of World War One, grabbing Mesopotamia, which we now call Iraq. I don't know if it's a coincidence, but the day after Talat is killed on March 15, 1921, on March 16, 1921, the country of Iraq is born in Egypt, in Cairo, and friends of some of the men who aided and abetted the Armenians, British intelligence agents, a man named Aubrey Herbert, and Gertrude Bell, Lawrence of Arabia, all these people are friends with each other. They are very much responsible for establishing this new country of Iraq, which, of course, is basically a big oil barrel in the desert. That's what Iraq is. It's not a real country. In the realm of the Turkish Empire itself, or the Ottoman Empire, and I think it's really important. I mean, the Ottoman Empire isn't some arcane topic that's off in some, far off time and far away from us. In fact, to understand what's going on in the Middle East today, it behooves anyone to kind of understand the Ottoman Empire. Ottoman Empire was there for 600 years. It was an Islamic empire run by the Turks. And at the end of the 19th century, the Turks were well aware that they were losing their grip on this empire. Basically, Europe was just pulling it to pieces. And they decided that there should be some kind of progressive and modernist movement, a country that has a monarchy but also a parliament like Britain. That would be what they were moving toward. And the Young Turks were the people, and some progressive Armenians were trying to get this to happen, to push the Sultan aside and set up a constitutional government. And they did have a revolution in 1908. So there is this movement going on through the Young Turks. Eventually, the Young Turks find that they kind of have a tiger by the tail and aren't terribly successful at running the country. And eventually, during World War One, decide that somehow killing all the Armenians is going to move their chess piece across the board. They're going to take away what the Armenians own, and they're going to Turkify, that's their term, Turkify the country. When you get to the end of World War One, all that's left is what we see today on a map we call Turkey, the Republic of Turkey. This was an idea. They understood that they were going to have to let go of certain lands, and they did. First the Balkans, Greece, and then eventually the Arab states. But they wanted to start this new Republic of Turkey. And Talat Pasha, Enver Pasha, Jamal Pasha, who was also assassinated by Operation Nemesis, these men were the former leaders, but they had all been convicted of war crimes and trials right after the war, and had all run away, escaped, and were in exile. The last man standing was Mustafa Kemal, who was leading the insurrection against the British. It was like an ongoing civil war that kept going at the end of World War One. he was successful. He eventually put the British and the French and the Greeks and the Armenians in a position where basically this war would go on forever if they didn't give up. And so they did give up. And Mustafa Kemal was able to initiate, sorry about that, it's a truck out there, the Republic of Turkey. And that's the Republic of Turkey we know to this day, 1923 to the present. The thing is that I think it's pretty clear, if you look at the history carefully, that Talat Pasha, Enver Pasha, they saw Mustafa Kemal as a kind of a junior guy, a general who would take care of business, and then they could return to power once he had cleaned everything up and chased the Brits out. The truth is that Mustafa Kemal had no intention of letting them come back, and in fact, he didn't let them come back, and in fact, they were all dead by the mid-1920s, leaving one man standing, Mustafa Kemal. And if you look at Mustafa Kemal, who later called himself Ataturk, and if you look at this man carefully, you see somebody who is a real pragmatist, and I really wonder to what degree the British wanted him in power. There had to be somebody in power, and there had to be somebody they could work with. They tried to establish a puppet sultan, a sultanic government, but they weren't able to do that. Kemal basically overpowered all of them. And Ataturk is really an amazing leader in the history of Turkey, and he's revered to this day. There is practically a god in that country. He continued to harass and kill Armenians at the end of the war in the years 1919, 1920, right through this period, chasing them all into what is now the Republic of Armenia. And then the Soviets came in, and they basically protected them, and it became part of the Soviet Empire. At any rate, if you look at this from that perspective, Operation Nemesis basically does the dirty work that Kemal needed to have done. I mean, I don't know if he needed everybody killed, but he wasn't planning to let those guys back into the country. He was going to take it for himself, and he did.
Now, you know, obviously, you grew up with your grandpa. Was it your grandfather was a survivor of the genocide? And, you know, growing up in the era that we grew up in, was also the post-war era. We became aware of the Holocaust, and you know, I just remember hearing this never again. It's never going to happen again. And then you know, Cambodia happens. Okay, well that's over there. And then it happens again in Europe with Bosnia, and then Rwanda. And you know, as you being someone who has genocide very much part of your culture and cultural identity. What was it like going through the 90s when all of a sudden, you know, Samantha Powers details, you know, the age of genocide just was in full bloom?
Well, it was, for me, it was the sort of enlightenment for me in terms of understanding what had happened to the Armenians. My knowledge of what had happened to Armenians during World War One was only came to me in bits and pieces. And like many Armenians, I heard about it from my grandparents, and it was almost mythic. It happened a long time ago, happened in a faraway place.
Right.
I wasn't even sure where, in like the Middle East or something. And that was about all I needed to know. And here I was growing up in the United States, and it all just seemed like a very bad thing that happened a long time ago. When in the 90s, when I was keeping track of what was happening in Serbia and the other former Yugoslavia countries, it hit me suddenly that what I was seeing had to be very similar to what had happened to my own family. And this was part of my enlightenment and need to learn more about it. I mean, the truth is that in terms of the 20th century, we look at what happened to the Jews in Germany as almost unique. And perhaps it is both what happened to the Jews and what happened to the Armenians. What happens in every genocide is so mind-boggling. We really can't wrap our minds around it. But what the Germans did with the Jews was so modern in the way that they were able to streamline their killing machine. This is part of what really has blown everyone's minds ever since then. And to contemplate it, it's incomprehensible. But the truth is that what we're really seeing is technology coming in and amping up what has always been part of the way humans wage war on each other or when they invade areas. And so here in the United States, when the settlers came to the British settlers and other settlers came, the first thing they did was commit genocide on the indigenous people, whether it was the Spaniards in the, down in Central and Southern America, or whether it was here up in North America. Movement of people, like moving the Cherokees out of the Carolinas to the west, the Trail of Tears, this is all typical genocidal actions. And if people die on the way as they're being moved, this was standard operating procedure in the 19th century. It was done again and again and again. People were moved, people were removed, and then it reaches these peaks with the Armenians and with the Jews, where technology comes in. And a lot of the technologies were similar for the Armenians and the Jews: use of railroad cars, use of mass media to make people think that something's happening that isn't actually happening. You're being moved to another place. We're not actually going to kill you. Understanding that the world is watching you while you're doing it, and so you have to create some kind of cover story, which is, we're just moving them over here, we're not actually going to kill them. All of that. But the more, as we move through the history from then through now, it just keeps happening again and again. It's part of war, actually. Most genocides happen during wartime, and it's just part of the way things happen. As we look at the technology of it all, this is, we're seeing an ever-changing landscape, because technology enhances genocide, but it also interferes with genocide, because today, when we learn that something is happening like this, hopefully, you know, people tell each other and pressure is exerted, and hopefully that something is done. Although, as Samantha Power pointed out, it's often ineffectual or comes across other issues that are political, very political.
Right. Well, when you're talking about acts of genocide, you know, but not the genocide itself, that's a problem. One thing, the book does a good job of explaining how this is not like Munich. It is because of, you know, the technology, and doesn't have a whole government apparatus behind it. But, you know, at the end of Munich, there's this kind of reflection, the consequences of what was done. And you yourself reflect on that. You say that doesn't make what Operation Nemesis did legal. One question that surrounds these assassinations is this: if you desire a world where justice prevails, then you must rely on laws. If you rely on laws, they must be universal. Laws can't be superseded simply because some feel that they are wrong, or because a person knows he has the right to break them. We live in a world where we attempt to achieve consistency in the rule of law. The concept of law demands it. Yet the men and women of Operation Nemesis did what governments could not. They were appealing to a higher final justice, one that exists somewhere between heaven and earth. And so, sitting today, looking at what they did, you have the verdict that this is justified.
Yes. I think no matter how many laws we bring into play or religious commandments, we have to live in the situation we find ourselves. What is happening in the case of the Turks versus the Armenians during World War I, or the Germans versus the Jews in World War II, is a very modern thing, because you have leaders who can insulate themselves far above the victims and put into motion these massive forces simply by their will to do it. Tala, clearly, from interviews with Ambassador Morgenthau, is quite glib about what he's doing to the Armenians. I don't know enough about the Holocaust to really, I've read various quotes from Nazi leaders, but they were very careful about what they said. The point is that if there's any definition of evil, these are evil actions. And because they are structured in such a way to insulate the criminals from the crime, there may not be a legal way to get to them. And so I think you have to take each case in and of itself. And in this instance, and I talk in the book about acts of violence that I can't support, because in the decades later, there were assassinations of Turkish diplomats, which I don't think anybody in their right conscience can really support this, because these men, I mean, to kill these Turkish diplomats in the 1980s, these men had nothing to do with what happened to the Armenians in 1915. They may have inherited the structure, and they may have continued to deny the genocide, which was reprehensible, but to gun them down is a different, it doesn't seem right. I mean, I think every person has to look in their heart of what they think is right and wrong. And sometimes it is going to extend, those ideas are going to extend past whatever normal structures of law we've established.
Quick real last question. You mentioned early on that your grandfather said, if you see a Turk, kill him. What happened the first time you met a Turk?
Yeah, I first heard those words when I was a little boy. I was probably 4 years old when I first heard it. I first met my first Turk when I was a freshman in college at the University of Chicago. Somebody introduced me to this guy. They said, he's Turkish. And today I have no idea what I thought I was thinking or doing, whether I thought I was being clever or whatever. But we were at lunch in the cafeteria. I leaned across to him and I said, you better keep your door locked at night. And the guy, the blood just ran from his face, and he never spoke to me again. I think that was not cool to say that to this student. What would have been more productive would be to have conversation with him about his own history, because we are talking about Turkish history.
Right.
But they need to know it too. If they don't know it, they can't be fully who they are. And since then, especially working on this book, I've become friends with many Turks and significant Turkish scholars who've done very, very important work, Taner Akçam being the number one on this topic of the genocide. And, you know, they need to own it. They do own it. Those people do the work that they need to do. Just like in this country, there had to be somebody who said, you know, the Indians are not bad people. We did bad things to the Indians. Here's a book, you know, Bury My Heart in Wounded Knee, or whatever the book is. And we learn what had happened. We need to learn our own history. And likewise, the Turks need to learn their history.
Well, it's spelled out in Operation Nemesis. Eric Boghossian, I really want to thank you for joining us. And I hope you do consider making it into a movie. Thanks again.
Yes, we're working on it. And I'm at the Miami Book Fair, I guess. Very soon, I think the 21st. So,
thank you very much.
Thanks. Take care.
Thank you again, Josh, and best of luck in Miami, where you'll be speaking at the Miami Book Fair on Saturday, November 23rd at 4 p.m., room 8203 in Miami-Dade College, talking about the Queen, the forgotten life behind an American myth. And so good luck there, and everyone check out the podcast. It's on Slate. And then wherever else you may listen to your podcast.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
Spring is in the air at Littleton Coin Company, and we want to help you brighten your collection. Visit us at littletoncoin.com all month long to enjoy 15% off your purchase. With a wide selection of coins, paper money, supplies, and more, Littleton Coin Company has something for every collector's taste. Use promo code SPRING at littletoncoin.com for 15% off your purchase all month long. Restrictions apply. Littleton Coin Company, serving collectors since 1945.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.